Main Engine Cutoff. I am Anthony Colangelo, and here we sit in the, well, I guess mid Artemis 1 era would be the case. So we're about halfway through Artemis 1, a day that we've been waiting for a long time. And I could think of no one better to bring on to talk about that and the 2022 midterms than Casey Dreyer of the Planetary Society, someone I absolutely love talking to. Love the way that he thinks about these kind of issues. So I was hoping to just talk with him about Artemis 1, 2022 midterms, and we went a lot more places than that. I think it's a really fun conversation. So without further ado, let's bring Casey on to the show. All right, Casey, an extremely long overdue welcome to Main Engine Cutoff. It is embarrassing that I have not had you on this podcast yet. So first, sorry.
Well, I humbly accept your apology, but we'll get through it somehow, I'm sure.
Yeah, just considering the topics I'm covering, it's like embarrassing that you have not been on yet. But this is the perfect time. And in full honesty, I feel like I'm bringing on a ringer here because half of what I want to talk about is Artemis 1, half I want to talk about the midterms. I've really been struggling to figure out what to even talk about with Artemis 1 because we have talked about it so much that I don't really know what there is left to talk about, honestly, other than if we just want to sit here and look at photos together and go, ooh and ah, like that's where we're at with it right now.
I have a take. I'll pitch my take
on
this, which is I say collective, the space community for whatever that is. Yes, that the royal we have focused so much on Artemis in terms of, I think, failure and problem, right? As the cost, delays, its relative outdated technology. But I don't think we've really focused enough on what happens if it worked, which it did, it seems to be, right? Like, I mean, we could say the SLS worked flawlessly at this point. Like, that job is done.
Yeah.
And it did it. And I don't think people really... I think that was the key test, right? I've talked about this a lot, and I've written about it a lot, and I feel like sometimes I'm this lone voice out there saying people don't understand how deep the support for this program is. Like, it's not going anywhere, and it succeeded. It is here. Get used to the SLS. That's I think the take we can have from this, which is it performed flawlessly. The role that it's designed to fill, which is assured access to deep space. As a U.S. national priority, it's served, right? And this means that these contracts that are being drawn up and finalized now to deliver something like, what, at least 24 SLS cores, right? That takes you through 25 years, 20-ish years in the future. This is our program now. And human spaceflight programs since Apollo, once they have happened, once they kind of tipped into operations... they've lasted decades, right? The shuttle was approved by Nixon in 72, January of 1972, right? So just over 50 years ago. And it went until 2011, its last flight, right? So that's a almost 40-year program. The space station was announced in the in Reagan's 1984 State of the Union address.
A couple of times, but...
Well, the initial pitch for the station like was approved by the administration, Space Station Freedom, and then it turned into like five different things.
Yeah.
Survived a one vote in 93 in the U.S. House, and now has just been extended to 2023. And probably if they can, will continue to be extended, right? So that's another 40-year program. So SLS, now that it did its first successful launch, started 10 years ago, following those trends, 40-year program. 30 more years of SLS launches, right? So I think that's the takeaway here, is that this success all but guarantees to me the sustainability of this program.
Even more so than you've been writing about all these years. So you had this recent article about how we got, and I don't think your take is kind of like a ride along with what my take ends up being. And the one thing that I've thought coming out of this, we'll get into a second, but you had this why we have the SLS post. And I just want to read this one sentence. About you were talking about the appropriations from the House and Senate from both their bills, and you go back 10 years here in the record, and you write, the trend is clear. Since its inception in 2012, both the House and Senate have added additional funds to the SLS program, not just in some years, but in every single year of the program's existence, regardless of which party controlled the chamber, and regardless of financial or scheduled performance of the project. That is a fact that we gloss over all the time. Mostly because I think it's just thrown on the pile of hand wringing of like, oh, no matter what, SLS gets more money and these other things get less money. But you're right that now that we're at this spot, like you have to think about that differently if you're somebody interested in the program overall, the Artemis program, as it stands, you know, however ill-defined the Artemis program itself is. But the only thing I've been thinking coming out of this is like, finally, we're at this part where we can stop talking about paper rockets and hypothetical architectures and all this. And we are firmly into the operations phase. Mm-hmm. The only thing that matters from here to like regular landings on the lunar surface is now how well do the landers work? Do they work? Do they mm-hmm. exist? Can we field them on time? And really the focus, if you're interested in this kind of architecture development, needs to be on the landers. Because if you are an SLS critic, like this matters for anyone. If you're an SLS stan, you want landers so the SLS has people or can do things to take people to landers and actually get them to lunar surface. If you're an anti-SLS kind of person, the more momentum the landers will have behind them, the easier it is to tack on however humans get there. If you're in a world where like we can land on the moon every other month, we'll figure out how to get people to those landers, regardless of what's going on with SLS politics. That kind of becomes the easy part at that point.
Yeah, I would add one rub to that, which is we're neglecting the gateway, right? And this is the key aspect of the gateway, is that the gateway provides an independent destination to the moon, whether or not we have functional landers, right? And if you notice, everything in terms of international partnerships that are signing on to Artemis, particularly Japanese space agency, ESA, even Australians and others, they're focusing
on... Don't forget the Canadians. Gateway. Jake will be so mad.
And the Canadians, excuse me. Yes, well, and the... Thank you. The Canadarm3, right? Where is it going? It's not going to the lunar surface, right? It's going to the gateway. Gateway is the core... that's the backup. That's the guarantee. That's the no matter what, you're going to have a place to go and things to do. And that's what they've done is actually leverage the International Space Station operational agreement and extend that out literally and figuratively to the moon. And that's the core aspect of the international partnership. That, right. And so that presents you as this alternative, no matter, you know, whether or not we can figure out the human landing system. The SLS can always go to the gateway and is designed to send Orion to the gateway, right? Independent of all this. And I think that's why you have the gateway. Like you see how all these pieces, I think all the pieces in Artemis actually fit together very elegantly, as long as you step back from the pure technical analysis, right? And look at the political, geopolitical like perspective of this, that you need things where where nations can contribute to levels that they're commensurate in terms of technology and funding, right? So it's a lot harder to land on the moon than it is to orbit it. Not that it's easy to orbit it, but you give these entry points, right? Where every nation is able, and you can almost start with Artemis Accords being like entry point zero, because it costs you nothing to sign on to the Artemis Accords, right? It's just an agreement.
That's
to overall
a nice dinner and
space.
A plane ticket, maybe. Like that's the cost.
Right.
Of it, you
know? Yeah. And then you go up to like, you know, gateway and then to the landing system and then to whatever, like making your own moon village or something like that. But you have these entry points for all broad levels of national capabilities and interests and financial commitments, or even CLPS, something like that. You can pay for a lunar delivery service on CLPS coming up, right? Just build a scientific instrument. And so it's this very elegant, it's designed, again, this is why we talk about sustainability in Artemis, is again, this underappreciated, we talk about how it's too expensive to be sustainable. It's sustained for 12 years at this point, right? This is already almost an Apollo-length program. Yeah. And it
that's
seems
an interesting way
to
look at
no
it. Like, when does it become
down.
Sustained?
Yeah.
Like, how many years in do you need to be before you're like, yeah, that's sustained. Yeah. 12
right.
is pretty
yeah,
good.
Like, I kind of want to pull my hair out. I saw some New York Times article, someone saying like, well, we just don't know if Artemis is sustainable. It's like, dude, it's lasted 12 years. Like, it's
four presidents
it's not,
and,
like, shrinking,
you know,
here.
Two recessions. And
yeah, it survived. It survived the test that no other lunar program or even human exploration program has survived since Apollo, right? Which is it switched presidential control. It switched and party control. You went from a Republican president that proposed it, the White House to propose it, to a Democratic White House that continued it, functionally unchanged, right? Like that is huge. The last time that happened was in 1968. From Lyndon Johnson to Richard Nixon. And you could even argue that Richard Nixon barely accepted it. He just signed off on every moon landing and then canceled it 4 years later. It's no other effort, like the George H.W. Bush vision for or space exploration initiative did not survive that transition. George W. Bush's vision for space exploration did not survive that transition. And Obama's, you know, whatever, humans to Mars exploration effort-ish program, Pathway to Mars, did not survive, right? So, I mean, this is, we always talked about, royal we in terms of space policy, this like whipsaw effect happening between presidential administrations always changing the direction of NASA. And here, the first time it doesn't happen in 50 years, and people still talk about it being unsustainable. Like, it passed the test.
Yeah.
I mean,
especially it's very contentious time. Like, that wasn't like the smoothest transition in the world. No one would say that, you know?
What else would the Biden administration agree on with the Trump administration?
Yeah.
For goodness sakes, right? Like, but space was the one thing, the human space program.
For sure.
And so I think we underestimate, we're so used to looking at it through this critical eye, which is fair, right? To emphasize, like, there's no reason not to look at this with a critical eye. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that this is the most successful deep space human exploration program since Apollo. And that's not nothing, right?
Yeah, and the gateway thing that you're getting into is interesting to consider the way that it was proposed and talked about in the early days, and then what we've seen recently, where there were, you know, Artemis 3 was kind of thrown off as, oh, we'll do this mission that goes down to the surface, almost as like a little intermission from the gateway infrastructure focus, where it was like, we'll build up Gateway from 2024 on. We'll have all these different parts coming to it. Orion's going to be the tug that brings these things to the Gateway. Artemis 3 is going to be not using the Gateway. We're going to do this lunar landing. And everyone's like, okay, so we're going to do a landing and then wait 4 years to do another one. That's kind of strange. But recently, it's like, actually, the option B in SpaceX contract, that's going to be for Artemis 4. And this was what I was always suspected. It's like, if the lander works, if it exists, and they can fly to the Gateway, and you're at the Gateway, you're going to go down to the lunar surface when you can. It's not a level one requirement or whatever in the architecture, but like that opportunity still exists. No one took that off the table by just saying the basic planning for this was like, take, you know, whatever, I forget, is it IHAB on Artemis 4 or whatever it is that's going to the Gateway. No one said you're not allowed to get in a lunar lander from there. It just wasn't part of that plan. So, you know, to my earlier point of how much momentum can these landers build, if they're able to have a lander ready to go every time someone rolls up on the Gateway, we'll have a lunar landing every time there's a mission to the Gateway. That was never disallowed. And to me, that seems much more likely than that will be the case in the future. So, and even to your earlier point about all these missions or nations signing on for these different missions, in every announcement of that, from the Canadians to the Japanese announcement that came out last week, they mention, you know, we'd love to have one of our astronauts go down to the surface sometime in the late 20s or early 30s. So, I don't have any sources within these meetings, but I would find it hard to believe that did not come up in the meeting of like, yeah, and we can hitch a ride on one of these landers at some point. It's like, yeah, they'll be there. Like, don't worry about it. We'll figure that out. We don't know what the hell's going on with these landers yet, but once we sort them out, for sure, there will be plenty of seats. I don't know if you've seen how big these things are, but like, you'll fit, you know?
we can squeeze you in.
And we'll probably be fine, so.
Yeah. And I think that's there's an inherent flexibility again that the Gateway gives you in terms of mission architecture design that I think, again, Gateway tends to get a lot of gruff about why do we have it? It's pointless, blah, blah, blah. But again, I think it's a really critical aspect of this. It's the security deposit on this whole concept. But then once you're there, I think NASA in the past has shown extraordinary flexibility with its commercial partners as new capabilities have come up, right? In terms of how they've allowed SpaceX and others to operate with the space station. And not to mention then on their own, once that goes beyond the basic NASA requirements, right? And having that parallel track, right? Gateway and landing system that are kind of independent of each other really gives you these flexibility and also allows you, no one else I think has really, really noted this, but in the latest NASA authorization bill that passed into law last year as part of the big CHIPS and Science bill, it directs NASA to really ramp up SLS launches to twice a year. And so this is law now that NASA needs to be focusing on this. And as part of that, they've directed NASA to upgrade a second bay in the vehicle assembly building to process a second SLS at the same time. And so like as you can ramp this up, if you can ramp this up, right? Big if, given the money that they do have, you can also see, again, these more flexible approaches to how often you're able to land if you have this reusable lander hanging out there in lunar orbit ready to go. And that will be, I think, a really, again, we're starting to enter this new territory here in terms of how we conceive of lunar operations with this commercial component, and this large kind of like classic style orbiting space station ISS like component in parallel at the same time.
Yeah, and I would just hope that, you know, as, and it seems likely that, you know, 10 years down the line, like, the industry will be significantly different and the choices in front of us will be significantly different. The stuff we're talking about is going to change entirely. So if everything's going super great and it's feasible to fly people up on a Starship and fly them over to the Gateway and then get ready to go down to the moon, like, that, we'll just do that as well. Like, that's not, I feel like the pitched battles that there were 5 years ago, because we are at a moment where we're choosing between architectures and, like, it felt like the time to kill one program and anoint another. That interaction is going away, because, like, every time there is now a Starship launch, NASA can say Artemis program. And every time there's an SLS launch, SpaceX has to be like Artemis program. So there is this weird sense of everyone's heading in the same direction now. So you can't really fight in the same way we did in like 2015 and 16 and argue about particular money going where. Like, it just doesn't matter when you're into this new phase of the program, which is relieving to me, if nothing else, that, like, can we stop doing that part at least? Cause it wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't, we weren't making progress on killing SLS as a community. Like, that was not a thing that was ever in the cards per your article showing how much money was flowing the other directions.
There's been no greater failure in space policy than the anti-SLS crowd failing to kill the SLS or even damage it. Congress has only ever added more money, which, again, it shows you that it's more than just one senator from Alabama, right, supporting the SLS, which is sometimes how it's, I think, you know, simplified to. It's much bigger than that. And again, you saw, I don't know if you have covered the NASA Economic Impact Report that just came out last month, but you have quantifiable numbers. Like, they break out NASA's Moon to Mars program from just NASA in general, and you see where all these jobs are being created, and it's literally every single state. Some jobs are, you know, there's like, no state is free of impact from NASA's Moon to Mars program. And that's how you build these enduring coalitions, right? That you see, you know, California is a huge recipient, Washington State's a huge recipient, Colorado is a huge recipient, right? It's not just places with NASA centers. It's not just Alabama and Florida and Texas. And that's the key. And I think that's the, again, as I phrased in my article, the political, if you want to kill the SLS, you are left with a political problem. What's your solution to, what do you do with that workforce? It's the shuttle workforce, basically, from 72, which is partially, you know, one of the reasons the shuttle came into existence is that Richard Nixon wanted to win California, and Rockwell was based in Southern California. All the aerospace layoffs were happening there. So the shuttle helped stymie layoffs happening in aerospace in Southern California. That was a purposeful political decision, and that's one of the reasons why we have the space shuttle as we had it. And that's my fundamental argument here, is right, that that's not a bad thing. That's how democracy is structured to work. Right, it doesn't give you efficiency by design. That's not, democracies are not designed to be efficient. They're designed to have lots of people weigh in and have the opportunity to make things relevant and immediate, engage to them. And I think you have this fundamental thing with the SLS. It's responsive to the democratic system we have. It's to those coalitions that are engaged in it. And if you want to get rid of it, what do you do to solve that political problem? And that's why the anti-SLS coalition has failed, right? That they have not presented a clear solution to what you do with that political problem.
All right, good transition into the makeup of Congress at this point. And I found it interesting how little midterms were talked about in space circles. And I find, you know, even with, there's, you mentioned in some of the stuff that you've put out about how, like, retirements are the biggest headlines for as far as space community is concerned. But I find it interesting that there are no gigantic issues that we're looking at of, like, what's going to happen to X, Y, or Z proposal or movement now that Congress is, you know, going to be split and the leadership has switched in some cases. You know, Artemis has been embraced fully by this administration. We're still debating, like, where Space Force headquarters is going to be or Space Command headquarters is going to be. But, like, there's not that many big monumental decisions that are left in the balance right now. So how do the midterms actually affect what's going on? Is it on the margins, or is there something I'm missing in terms of like, ooh, no, this big thing's getting shaken up here?
I think to the degree that you see consequences will be second order effects from the combative divisiveness of one of the House of Representatives being run now by Republicans and the Senate being retained by Democrats. And so there's, particularly with the president being a Democrat, you have the House of Representatives will have strong political incentive to be combative, right? To define themselves against the predominant Democratic control of the White House and Senate. And that will probably just slow down the pace of legislation in general. It will probably slow down the pace of just getting a budget out there, annual budget that funds NASA. So you're likely to see more what they call continuing resolutions, just extensions of the previous budget agreements, mainly because, not because anyone's against NASA, it's just a bystander in this broader kind of political combat. And there, I think, again, there's two real reasons why you don't see a lot of things with space. I mean, first of all, I think it, despite us here, you and me and your listeners here, who all obviously know space is one of the most important and inspiring things that there is, unfortunately, a lot of other people just don't. Right? It tends to not be a major political... No one votes on space issues unless you live in like the Space Coast, and even then, kind of questionably, right? Like they vote. Florida voted out Bill Nelson, who could not be a stronger supporter of space, right? As we remember in 2018, for Rick Scott, who much quieter on space issues, right? And that's Florida, right? There's a lot of space in Florida.
Yeah, I don't think DeSantis won by 20 because of his stance on NASA. Like it doesn't seem like the reason right? that he took the state by force. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the same reason. It's just not a massive, and never has been, right? Even during Apollo, I think one of the first papers that I assign to students who want to learn about space history is Roger Launius. He was the chief historian of NASA. His paper on public attitudes towards space exploration, showing during Apollo, even it was not even that popular. People did not think it was worth the expenditures, except for the 1 month after Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, the 1 month in July of 69.
It's a great summer.
And it was like 54%, and then it was like went back down. So I think that's one of the reasons space is kind of a marginal issue, seems abstract, which it kind of is, right? It seems out there. And the other one is just, I think there's not a huge division. There's no partisan aspect. There's no partisan platform for space for the most part, right? It's generally speaking, there's some edge cases we can talk about, but there's no Republican space exploration platform and there's no Democratic space exploration platform. And so there's no way to, if you're looking to define yourselves against each other, which is what the Senate and House are going to start doing next year because they're controlled now by different parties, space is not a good way to do that because there's no clear partisan association, which to be clear is good, right? This is one of the few precious areas where we don't have to go against immovable partisan attitudes, right? Which you cannot use, generally you cannot rhetorically argue your way into someone's heart if they're partisan set against your position to start with. So space is one of the rare areas. It's like you're still, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington level of idealistic democracy where you can go and convince a lot of people still that space can be important and meaningful without running into that buzzsaw of partisanship. And so you just don't have the incentive as a partisan actor to say space, to use it as a symbolic way to kind of beat up your political enemies. You know, so I think that's why it just kind of fades in the distance. So there's a few things we will see, though. I think where you tend to see the differences are on the generally the more idiosyncratic interests of the members who do assume leadership positions, right? So Congress works by committee, right? There's committees all over the place in Congress, and each committee has a different jurisdiction and set of areas to provide oversight. For us, we're concerned for NASA, that's going to be your House Science Committee. They have a space subcommittee, even more specific. And then in the Senate, they have the Commerce Committee, which is Commerce, Transportation, and Science. And then they have a space subcommittee as well. And then that covers like NASA oversight. They set authorization. They set U.S. policy on this. And then there's the money, the appropriations, the doling out the money for space activities every year. That's your CJS, Commerce, Justice, Science subcommittee, both one in the House, one in the Senate. So the leaders of those have extra special impact, right, onto where they direct funds, you know, where they focus their energies. And so what was interesting, actually, just yesterday, as we record this, you saw from the incoming, so the Republicans haven't gained control yet. That'll happen in the next Congress, which starts January 3rd, I believe. The ranking members are the basically the party out of power. That's their highest hierarchy of members. Those are going to flip over into chairman in the next Congress. So Frank Lucas from Oklahoma is likely going to be the chairman of the House Science Committee. And then Brian Babin from Texas is likely to be the chairman of the Space Subcommittee. They just released a joint letter yesterday to NASA saying, what's going on with NEO Surveyor, right? Which is the asteroid hunting space telescope that bafflingly had a 75% cut this year from NASA after just being huge investment the year before. That hadn't been coming from the Democratic House Science Committees. So this is, and there's not like a Republican stance on planetary defense, and there's not a Democratic stance on planetary defense. This is just the interest of those of that leadership. So I'm actually really excited about that. That's great. That's an example of good oversight, because NASA has never, ever, despite multiple and ongoing media inquiries and articles in the Washington Post and Bloomberg News, and obviously from organizations like the Planetary Society, never explained why they slashed funding for that program. Because it's a congressional mandate, right, to find these things. So you'll see maybe things like that. They can do oversight, and they can kind of press agencies on certain issues that they are interested in. That's where you're going to see, I think, there's these real changes.
One of the areas I'm really curious to see about is what happens with some of the ISS, you know, pushing and pulling around the Russia partnership, because that's one that just is such a wild card. Again, it's not tied to a particular party. It's just one that seems so ripe for, I don't know, like, do you think Russia's chilled out now? I don't know anyone that would bet on that. Like, there's going to be some more chaos over the next couple of years at that. And if there's one thing that I just would fault NASA for over the last like year or two is taking advantage of a geopolitical situation in front of them to ensure the future of commercial LEO. That's one that I just feel like they've swung and missed on, of not putting pressure in that area. So I don't know. Will the makeup of Congress change that and the way they approach it? Probably not. But it does feel like one that is there if they want to take advantage of it.
Well, I think you're seeing some progress on commercial LEO. In the 23 budget that has not yet passed, but has gone through a House and Senate version, you're seeing, I think, $230 million now. The full request finally was met for the first time. Yeah. It's kind of similar to commercial crew, where Congress underfunded it for 3 years, and then kind of after a while, they just got on board, and they realized that there's no alternative here, and they flipped to fully funding it. You may have just seen that transition with commercial LEO. And yes, we're behind now, right? That wasn't NASA's fault necessarily, because Congress will only fund so much. You can't drag them if they don't want to be. And in fact, if you try to drag them, they tend to give you less as punishment. But I think the stark reality of seeing both the collapse of the U.S. Russia, the Russian relationship to the ISS and the U.S., and I think the demonstrable success that the Chinese have been having with their space station makes, I think, finally, I think political elected officials realize that this is something we need to be investing in if you want to maintain U.S. presence in LEO. For the ISS in general, I think what's interesting is I think we have seen the temperature notch down on that, particularly since Rogozin left. And you've had this new Russian representative come in who's much more diplomatic, let's say.
He doesn't tweet as much.
Doesn't tweet it. Good lesson for everybody, I think. Clearly. Doesn't seem to be a lot of value in that. And seems to basically quietly walked back all the threats, right? Yeah. And again, at the end of the day, and this is what I was saying from the beginning, particularly with the Russian setup right now, you have to look at their actions of what they're actually doing beyond the rhetoric. And they just do not have clear options if they want to maintain. And I think right now, particularly with Putin's style of Russia, they're a very symbolic oriented culture and nation, right? Like political culture, right? You want symbolism even over direct results. And so the symbolism of losing access to space for cosmonauts would be it's just unacceptable, right? You clearly cannot. And so they've acted that way, that they've beyond all the rhetoric, they're still committed to the International Space Station, because that's their only human spaceflight program. And then, you know, I think they'll try to do something in the future, but I think they're facing a serious workforce issue. And not to mention all the sanctions now, the punishing sanctions on high advanced technology imports and materials. They're going to be really limited in what they can do. And it's just going to be, they're stuck with the station, which is, again, kind of how the station was designed, right? The partnership was to be so intertwined that even if you got, it's like a marriage, right? You, what's the difference between being married and being, you know, just like dating somebody? It's like you have a huge fight, you're still married the next day. It takes a lot of work to get divorced. And it presents you with, it's kind of binds you by law in a way that you just a casual partnership doesn't. And so, you know, I think that the ISS partnership was designed for situations like this, right? Where you have, no matter what, you have a shared common goal between two nations that otherwise seem to have none others. So
yeah,
I see the ISS as one of the reasons that it will keep kind of slouching forward with that. But also, I think that the future, it's always hard for people to think about the future. And particularly when you have all these needs in the present. And it'll be interesting, to your point, to see how continued funding for LEO commercialization will move forward. And also, whether it's viable. I think that's the big wild, it's actually kind of crazy, if you think about it, how much of a risk NASA's putting on this working, right? That's like, we want to guarantee ongoing presence, U.S. presence in LEO for humans. And to do that, we will do a completely untested, never before tried commercial model for LEO space stations, which every economic analysis says will not work. And that's what we're going to spend billions of dollars on. And again, to be clear, I'm not against it, but I don't think we talk about enough like the fact that these are, we don't know the domain to which private-public partnerships in space work. We know they work for transportation, for humans and cargo, to a big U.S.-funded, government-funded platform. But we don't know what else they apply to. And we're running the risks now, and so it'll be fascinating to see this work move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the fact that like this one now relies on a big market outside of NASA, whereas the other ones, as we're seeing, you know, with the exception of Jared Isaacman, kind of get away without really having any other customers. And you've got a crazy outlier company in SpaceX, and then like some cargo missions from Northrop Grumman, and that's the extent of it. This was not a huge market that they opened up. You know, they opened up the potential for a huge market, but the market didn't open up certainly when these things came online, and that's the real sticking point with the commercial LEO ends of things.
Absolutely. And so, and that's why, again, the economic analysis just does not add up. You could read these pronounced, you know, made by Stippy a couple years ago, doing this independent analysis of this. And again, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try, right? But again, I think we need to acknowledge the possibility for failure. And what happens if there is no viable commercial model? Does NASA just end up footing the bill again? Like, do we end up saving any money? You know, maybe we do, right? We're still getting outside investment, no question, coming from Axiom, right? But in particular, but again, it's not easy to run these. There's a reason why no one else has done this before, right? If it was an obvious business case, it would have been done by now, right?
So it's honestly kind of the same argument as what the SLS backers were for a couple of years, which is like, well, it's not a sure thing that the market will support one of these. So the U.S. has a vested interest in creating one of these things. And, you know, I don't know if now's the right time to just look around the industry and say, are there companies that are definitely reliable and not having any bizarre leadership things happening amongst them that we should hinge all of our human spaceflight endeavors on, you know, a small circle of individuals? Like, now's maybe not the worst time to just look around and consider other options and other ways.
Question for you, Anthony, do you think Starship is more or less likely to succeed now that Elon Musk is focused on Twitter?
Like, my only Twitter take is that if Boca Chica went really well over the last like year and a half, I don't think Elon would have bought Twitter. I think there was a window of boredom waiting for, I guess we could draw a straight line from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to Elon Musk buying Twitter is my main point. That's literally
all. He's
got to
sit and write those reports by hand. And so he's like,
procrastinating on the book report. So he's like, I'll buy Twitter.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good take. I like that.
Yeah,
it's interesting because they reorganized a bunch of stuff too, right? In terms of Starship management.
Yeah.
And so, but it's clear enough that it can just go on autopilot? Yeah.
it's a mystery. It's a real mystery. Like Boca Chica itself, it sounds like was pretty haywire for a little while with the ground systems. I think that part's been sorted out. So I don't know. Hypothetically, we should be seeing some hardware take off in the near future once they finish their book reports. But I mostly am. I'm not that concerned about it overall. Like memes and all. I would never buy Twitter. It's a weird thing to buy, but I'm not that worried about Starship generally. But it should weigh into your calculus of things as you like look at what the best plan is.
Yeah. I mean, SpaceX, to be clear, I think has demonstrated so much success and has so much engineering talent that it does seem more resilient to the whims of any one individual. But it's interesting just to kind of think about whether that hurts or helps. Whether his attention is elsewhere, given kind of the more open aspect.
Yeah.
Though again, social media is nothing like building rockets, right? It's, you realize, like, we talk about rocket science as being the hard things. Like, I don't know, maybe sociology and personalities are way harder.
Totally different. Yeah.
You can't model them.
You can't
very
do
accurately.
First principles thinking on it. Is you know, there's no like singular right answer, which is and I think that's maybe the other concerning part is like, you know, the focus of it all and how laser focused they had seemed up until this point, and as things just seem a little wandery, and that's the one that's the only part I would be concerned about is like, are at some point SpaceX is going to be like the old crusty company in the industry, right? They are they have maintained this upstart attitude for so long, but soon that will not be the case, and they will be the ones being disrupted. So I try never to lose focus on that aspect, and it's hard to separate out. Are they crustifying, or is there other chaos going on internally?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
I don't know.
I don't even know what would even come to disrupt SpaceX at this point. Like, you haven't seen many other. Closest might be Rocket Lab, but even then, they're nowhere close to something like a Starship.
Yeah.
So it's just
SpaceX is such an outlier that it's hard to.
Yeah.
I think tend to think that they're not unbelievably outlying the rest of the industry, but they are. They always have been. And scrambles your calculus.
Yeah, I keep wanting to write a paper called Policy by Outlier, that the whole NASA policy to public-private partnerships is based on SpaceX being the example, where it's really the freakish, unusual, like
100%.
3-4 sigma outcome. And I just, that's what we're going to be testing here, is whether there are going to be more SpaceXs, or are they really just the one-off strange conglomeration of people.
And 5 years from now, we'll have commercial cargo, crew, commercial lunar, commercial LEO, and human landing system. All five of them, some task order based, some this other kind of model. And we'll be able to say, like, what is the right path here? Did any of these actually work, or did it work in spite of itself?
Right. Yeah. This is a very exciting decade. I keep saying this too. Very exciting decade ahead of us in space. This is like crazy.
Well, this went exactly where I was hoping to, which was 5 minutes of Artemis 1 and a bunch of other stuff. So thanks for hanging out. Where should people follow? If they've not partaken in the Casey Dreyer experience, where should they be looking to follow along?
Well, best way is planetary.org, my organization. I have a monthly newsletter called Space Advocate that you can search for, or just go to our website. And that's free. And I talk about all these things. And I also have the Space Policy Edition podcast, where I talk about these at length and do interviews with nerdy space policy wonks. So those are two great places. I am technically on Twitter. I just haven't been tweeting as much. No big thing about it. I just haven't been tweeting as much, but I am Casey Dreyer on Twitter. But otherwise, Planetary Society newsletter is probably the best way to follow what I'm doing.
Awesome. Thanks again for hanging out.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I won't wait another 250 episodes or whatever to have you back on. Don't worry.
All right. I'll hold you to that. 249.
Thanks again to Casey for coming on the show. And the Planetary Society people are my favorite people. Most recently on Off Nominal, we had Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. So check that episode out as well. Of course, Jason Davis, Ray Paoletta, and so many others that we've talked to both here and on Off Nominal. Really, really fun people that all have great minds for space. And that was exactly the kind of conversation that I was hoping to have with Casey. They went a lot of places, but there's a lot of interesting stuff to think about with where we are in space flight right now. So If you like that kind of episode, if you like Manage and Cutoff, this is an entirely listener-supported show. Everything that I do is because of all of you out there supporting over at manageandcutoff.com/support. There are 875 of you supporting every single month, and that includes 44 executive producers who made this episode possible. Thanks to Simon, Chris, Pat, Matt, George, Ryan, Donald, Lee, Chris, Warren, Bob, Russell, Moritz, Joel, Jan, David, Eunice, Rob, Tim Dodd, the Everyday Astronaut, Frank, Julian, and Lars from Agile Space, Matt, the Astrogators at SCE, Chris, Aegis Trade Law, Fred, Haymonth, Dawn Aerospace, Andrew, Harrison, Benjamin, Small Spark Space Systems, Tyler, Sean and Daniel Hart, Steve, and seven anonymous executive producers. Thank you all so much for making this episode possible. If you want to join that crew, manageandcutoff.com/support is where to do it. If you're at $3 a month or more, you get access to Miko Headlines, a show that I do every week or so. I've been a little bit longer term over the last 2 weeks because of the way that schedules have been falling. But I run through all the stories that are going on in space, everything you need to know, everything you need to keep up on, give you some of the hot takes that I've got about them before you'd hear about them in the main feed for sure. And you may never hear about them in main feed because they just don't become something that I talk about on a full length episode like this. So it's an awesome thing to add to your listening repertoire if you're digging Manage and Cutoff. So do that. I'm very, very, very thankful for all the support, as always. If you've got any questions or thoughts, hit me up on Twitter @WeHaveMiko or on email, anthony@manageandcutoff.com. And until next time, I'll talk to you soon.